In her teens, a girl can lose her innocence.
When a child becomes violent, it's forecasting doom.
What is that for?
Something bad is going to happen.
A dark fantasy becomes all-consuming.
Deep inside her, she had the urge to kill. And she had a way to do it.
A lonely outsider wants to prove her loyalty.
She owed them something. What they wanted her to do was kill Andrew's parents.
And two young sisters plan murder like a class assignment.
Instead of talking about boys, they were talking with their friends of how to kill their mother.
When these young women move through adolescence, they change from innocent girls to teen killers. Adolescence is a time of change.
They're going to be here in a second.
A time to fight for independence.
You okay, Susanna?
With loyal friends.
You can do this.
The group had several plots or ideas on how to kill Andrew's parents. Most of them were ridiculous.
Okay, all right, hurry up, they're coming. You better not miss, Susanna, I swear to God.
The final one wasn't.
In Mansfield, Texas, Susanna Toledano is an awkward, shy 19-year-old.
It's the least you can do.
She only has one friend in the world.
Okay.
Chelsea Richardson.
I'll do them now. Thanks, hon. Look, I don't mean to be a bossy boots or anything, but fair is fair, you know? You're right.
Susanna was living at Chelsea's house because she and her mother did not get along. She and Chelsea had become fast friends when Susanna moved down from Illinois to Texas. Susanna felt obligated to Chelsea. Susanna was shy, and there she had a friend who would help her and be with her and make it so she wasn't so lonely.
Author Stella Sands says Susanna found the support she couldn't get from her family. But her new best friend isn't as generous as she appears.
It seemed that Chelsea always chose people she could manipulate. She liked to be in control, and she chose people who she could control. One person called her a master manipulator. Whatever she wanted, she would somehow get.
Chelsea desires an easier life, like that of her boyfriend, Andrew Walmsley.
Okay. Oh,
nice one.
Andrew lived in Walnut Estates, which is a very fancy place of two-story homes, brick and stone, and he had everything that he ever wanted as a kid.
Andrew and his sister live a privileged life thanks to their parents.
Cut it out. Your father's working.
Rick and Susanna Walmsley, by all accounts, loved each other very much.
They're still hot.
Oh, honey.
And were hardworking people who had really built up a life for themselves to live in this very affluent, beautiful neighborhood full of expensive homes and happy children and golf courses.
But as reporter Andrea Grimes discovered, the picture-perfect family was hiding secrets.
They would take great care to put on a facade in public that said, you know, we're very happy and we all love each other. That was challenged often by the behavior of the children.
Behind closed doors, Andrew is a violent young man.
Go on, you videotape now. Go to the shop. Done with it.
When Andrew became frustrated, he would throw things.
Go get it! What?
That's the last thought. You're caught up, man.
When a child becomes violent with a parent, and that parent is not violent toward them.
No gas money, no allowance, nothing for you. I hate you, asshole.
It's forecasting doom.
Come on, babe.
Something bad is going to happen.
We're gonna have all the cars you want.
His new girlfriend encourages Andrew's growing hate.
Andrew's family thought that Chelsea was white trash and that Andrew could do better than her, which fueled Andrew's dislike for his parents.
Come on, Drew, your parents are loaded.
I told you, I got cut off. My dad's not giving me anything.
You're entitled to it. It's your birthright.
Soon, the teenage lovers start thinking the unthinkable.
Allegedly, Chelsea is the one who came up with the idea of saying, you know, Andrew, you don't like your parents very much anyway. And, you know, they probably would get a sizable inheritance.
We're not going to let them get away with this.
Let's just fantasize for a while about what it would be like for them to just die.
The idea is simple. Drew will inherit $1 million in life insurance and the valuable family home if his parents are dead.
Not only did they plan to kill the parents, but one of their plots was to kill Sarah, his sister, so that Andrew wouldn't have to share the insurance money and the $1.6 million home. And Andrew assumed somebody dies, you get it right away.
Within weeks, their crazy fantasy becomes real.
Hold it.
They're plotting murder without dirtying their own hands. They want their gullible new friend to do it for them.
God, do you live here rent free? We drive you to work every day? I mean, we helped you out when you had trouble with your mom, remember? Drew's having trouble with his family. We're going to help him out.
Andrew and Chelsea made Susanna feel as though she owed them something. That because of the friendship and the companionship they gave her, she needed to do something for them. And what they wanted her to do was kill Andrew's parents.
Chelsea Richardson likes to get her own way. In 2003, that means persuading her best friend, Susanna Toledano, to kill her boyfriend's parents.
Susanna had a very low opinion of herself. If somebody asked her to sell the most Girl Scout cookies on the block, she would do that. If somebody asked her to murder someone, she would do that.
So where is this restaurant?
Somewhere down here on the left somewhere, she said.
Okay. I'm hungry. How about you guys?
Yeah.
The Walmsleys are rich. Their disgruntled son, Andrew, and his new girlfriend, Chelsea, want their money now.
Get ready. They're going to be here in a second.
Susanna, you're okay?
They actually attempted to shoot the gas tanks on the family car.
We can do this.
They believed if they just shot a bullet into the gas tank, the car would blow up, no more family. Insurance money comes the next day, and, you know, they ride off into the sunset together.
Okay, here they come. Get ready. Come on.
All right, make sure you get the gas tank.
Their first murder attempt is almost comical.
Ready?
No!
What was that?
My God.
What was it? Somebody
shot it off.
The Walmsleys realized they had been shot at.
Are you serious?
That was Drew.
Just calm down.
That was Drew. I swear to God,
And saw Andrew drive away in the white Mustang that they had bought for him.
Whether or not they knew this was Andrew in their hearts, or whether or not they chose to believe that it was not their son, life went on after this. They didn't press any charges. They didn't have the police investigate Andrew. Life just went on.
It's a fatal mistake. The second murder attempt is chillingly direct.
They went into the house, and Susanna was still scared. They tried to prop her up and say, you can do it, you can do it. And finally, Chelsea pushed her into the living room. She went in, she saw the mother lying on the couch asleep. She took the gun and shot her in the side of the head. The husband heard the sound. He was in the bedroom.
Who the hell are you?
She shot at him several times. And then he came at her. And they started really fighting. So that's when Chelsea brought out the knives. And that's when Susanna started stabbing him. And stabbed him some 21 times. The mother died immediately from a gunshot to the head, but Chelsea told Susanna to go back and make sure she's dead. Susanna knifed her 18 times. Parents don't often wish to think that their children can do them any harm. Probably from Mr. Walmsley's point of view, he had given his son everything he wanted. He had given him a lovely home and a car. And here was his own son murdering him. Nobody has come up with another motivation for this besides pure greed. Here are two wonderful people dead. And who gets what out of this? Well, money. That's all.
Sarah Walmsley is lucky she isn't home. But she is deeply suspicious and files papers to block her brother's inheritance, accusing him of murdering their parents. But it's physical evidence that cracks the case. Rick Walmsley holds his killer's identity in his hand.
In his hand were some hairs that they took for DNA testing. When the results came back, people were shocked. It was not Chelsea, it was not Andrew, but it was Chelsea's friend, Susanna's hairs.
Facing a death sentence, Susanna gives up her friends.
She flipped almost immediately and pointed the finger at Chelsea first and then Andrew.
The crazy dream is quickly over.
I think Andrew was much, much angrier at his father than anyone knew. And when he hooked up with Chelsea, she fed into his need to take control of his situation. Chelsea was a master manipulator, and frankly, Andrew wasn't very bright. In the battle of wits with Chelsea, he was really unarmed. And Susanna, easy, easy, easy pickings. And they got her to do the dirty work.
Andrew Walmsley is sentenced to life in prison. Susanna is spared death row. She also gets life. The harshest penalty is saved for the master manipulator, Chelsea Richardson. She's sentenced to death and is living on death row.
Ah.
I don't know. My mom, she's dead in the tub. No, I don't want to touch her. She's underwater.
Toronto, Canada, 2003. Two teenage girls find their mother, Shirley, floating in her bath.
The 911 operator gave clear instructions on starting to start CPR.
Hey, do you know anything about CPR?
No.
The girls have called for help.
I don't know. I don't want to touch her. She's underwater.
But they're not following instructions.
The operator was almost pleading with them to at least, you know, get her out of the water. And there was a refusal on their part to do any of that.
By the time police arrive, their mother will be dead. Investigating officer Mike Pulley was one of the first on the scene.
They were 15 and 16, somewhat upset, visibly upset. Didn't seem to be anything out of the ordinary.
Officer Pulley starts piecing together a picture of the victim. A single mom with a drinking problem, working two jobs to keep the family afloat.
She was doing the best she could do in the given situation, which was probably a pretty good job, given the financial ability she had.
But her daughters, Sandra and Beth, don't think she's doing enough for them and their stepbrother.
Some of their friends had swimming pools, they had nice cars, nice clothes, and they had hand-me-downs and shopped at discount stores and didn't have the nice running shoes or designer jeans, and they sort of felt entitled to this. They wondered, well, why didn't we have that?
The girls want things to change quickly.
Drowning is most often quick and unspectacular. An asphyxiating person seldom calls for help.
If their mother died, they would get somewhere in the neighborhood of $68,000 apiece between the three of them.
They're planning to stage an accident.
The brain will die after approximately 6 minutes without oxygen.
A guidance counselor mentioned that they were the smartest kids he had ever seen in 30 years of teaching. They spoke five different languages.
They scour the internet, collating the best advice from around the world.
They found 14,000 hits on the hard drive for drowning, the word drowning. And they found another 200 or 300 hits for codeine, and there were 100 hits on bathtub.
They've already worked out how to spend the money.
How much cash can you get?
$70,000.
They plan to take all their friends on this big European vacation and live the high life.
You guys can be set. Yeah.
Their dream was to buy a marijuana farm and have a nice house. That was it. And for that reason, they killed their mother.
Their crazy teen logic isn't new to criminal profiler Candace DeLong. But the detailed preparation is highly unusual.
For a teenage killing, this one had much more planning than any I've ever seen. These girls are dangerous.
Wait, does that mean if you guys do it Friday, you won't make it to TJ's party on Saturday?
Crap, I didn't think we can't miss TJ's party.
The girls plan murder like a high school musical and share their plans with their friends.
Why don't you hold off a week?
Can't risk it.
They had friends that for months helped them plan the crime. And it was a murder of their mother.
Yeah, we're gonna have the best party.
The fact that their friends knew about it and never went to police, never went to their parents, never went to anybody. Really, like, everybody was involved in this.
Yeah, our place is gonna be the new party pass. Yeah.
Their silence will prove deadly. Sisters, Sandra and Beth, are about to come into money once they fix Mom a drink. Each Saturday afternoon, Shirley has a few vodkas before taking a warm bath. Today, she gets a special treat.
At some point, we're not exactly sure what point, they started introducing the codeine pills.
The sisters' research tells them alcohol and painkillers will slow their mom's heartbeat. She'll become sedated and pliable. As they wait for the drugs to work, the teens go online to update friends.
At one point, the older girl tells, I feel like I'm going on a vacation. That's how she describes the feeling about to kill her mother.
If Twitter had existed when this murder occurred, she probably would have tweeted about it to her friends. Her need to be connected was stronger than the need to remain silent.
The girl ends this conversation with, "Good luck, wear gloves." It's such a macabre thing to say to somebody who is just about to kill their mother.
Their mom drink away money they want to spend.
By now she's very impaired by the alcohol and the codeine, and she just followed along any lead they said. They led her to the bath.
But this is Shirley's last drunken Saturday.
That's it,
she's going to have an accident.
How's that, Mom?
Temperature's good?
Yeah. Are you comfortable?
That's good.
Okay, so I'm just gonna turn you over. I'm just gonna wash your back, okay?
Uh-huh. Turn over. Dad's just gonna wash your back.
That's it.
Once she was in the bath, the older sister at that point then just reached down and held her head underwater.
Sandra knows exactly how long it will take.
And she found out that it took between 2 and 6 minutes to drown. She split the difference. She actually held her mother's head under the water with a latex glove for an entire 4 minutes. Until the mother actually was dead.
That's 4 minutes.
She told people it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. It was a little bit of struggling, but that was just the body's reflexes, but it actually went off much better than she thought.
But we have to catch the bus.
The sisters then join their friends to establish an alibi and share the good news. The girls have pulled off the perfect murder.
Who thinks that two 15 and 16-year-old girls would have the gumption to kill their mother, especially in the planning they did?
I can't do it.
You have to do it.
I'll screw it up. You have to do it.
No, we rehearsed this. You can do it.
I can't.
Please,
you have to do this.
Later that night, the sisters report a family tragedy. With their mother's history of alcohol abuse, authorities buy it.
They're very good actors. They were giving out the emotions, oh, we're sad, let's put some tears on here, let's look upset.
But she's not moving at all.
The sisters receive sympathy from family and kudos from their friends. The secrecy pact with their social network holds strong. Until 1 year later, alcohol and hubris start loosening Sandra's lips.
She just kept telling everybody when she got drunk. I think she wanted people to know that she had outsmarted not only the adults, but she had outsmarted the police. She had outsmarted a coroner.
But she was really unhealthy. She was crying about the whole time.
The older sister is the kind of person who needs to connect with people and needs to share information, needs to share every aspect of her life.
Teenage sharing unravels the perfect plan.
You actually drowned her, right?
Well, sort of, yeah, I guess.
Police crack the social network and convince a friend to secretly record Sandra's confession.
It was either her or me, and I'm younger. I saw myself as having more potential.
It was a very bone-chilling thing to see. Her acknowledgement was one of, almost seemed like pride, and one of, very pleased with the outcome.
Indicted by her own words, Sandra is tried and convicted of first-degree murder, along with her sister.
Their mother, who loved them, who worked two jobs so that they would have an okay home.
At just 15 and 16, they receive a youth sentence under Canadian law of 10 years and gain parole after just 4. Their whole lives are ahead of them.
Deep down inside, these were narcissistic, greedy, little murderers.
Today, the sisters are in their 20s, attending college. Canadian law will protect their true identity forever.
They could be your neighbor. They could be your child's babysitter. They could be your coworker. They could be your girlfriend.
Most actions have a motive.
Hey there. This feels a little steep to be walking up.
Right or wrong.
Come on, jump in.
They can usually be explained.
Come on.
For Penny, this was just a fluke. Just something that she always wanted to do.
But sometimes, they cannot.
From the moment she got in his car, he was a dead man.
San Francisco in the 1950s. It's a time of hope, of excitement, a time to rock and roll.
So has Chuck asked you to the prom yet?
Not yet. I don't know if he's going to. He's taking so long.
Oh, don't worry. He's just nervous.
But for Penny Bjorklund, it's a time of dark fantasy.
Oh, hi, Penny.
We were sitting there and she came and sat.
You know what I have in the shoebox?
She says, you don't know what's in my shoebox. I said, no, I don't know what's in your shoebox.
What is that for?
I just remember her as being crazy.
Darlene Norrie Ferguson knew Penny at school.
She was just strange. How many girls take a shoebox with a knife in it to school on a regular basis?
Penny isn't aggressive.
Why are you carrying that around?
She doesn't threaten her classmates. She's just playing with curiosity.
For Penny, it was a game.
That girl's got problems.
She just wanted to see how the whole thing played out. because this thing was just a flight of fancy for her.
Author David Kolchek says young Penny's fantasies would come to rule her life.
Penny was a loner. She was in her own world that was pretty deep. And she had a hard time telling the difference between reality and what isn't reality. I think she was a very confused teenager.
Penny's strangeness just isolates her more.
She was very a strange person, and we really stayed away from her.
Darlene thinks after graduation, she'll never see Penny again. But she's wrong. Fate will ensure they have a deadly connection.
Here we go, honey.
Oh, it smells amazing.
By the age of 18, Darlene is married to a handsome young war veteran, August Norrie.
Maybe you should do this more often.
No.
Augie was a very, very happy, jovial, friendly man. Very good-natured, patient, just really a wonderful man.
Oh, this just looks perfect.
Darlene is making plans for the future with her new husband. At the same age, Penny's life is at a standstill.
Penny, you ready yet?
Penny was a troubled teenage girl.
Come on, get out of bed. Come on, Penny.
I'm not going.
She didn't care for her mother. She would go so far as to say she hated her mother, and she hated her for many, many years.
You are going to church.
She hated the fact that she had to go to church and that she had a religious upbringing. But lots of kids feel that.
What's wrong with you? Get out of my room.
Penny seems distracted from ordinary life. She's lost in her dark fantasies.
She started fantasizing about what it would be like to shoot someone, and it became an obsession. She thought about it all the time, how she would do it, who she would do it to.
Former FBI profiler Candace DeLong says fantasies often form to escape a bad experience, but not in Penny's case.
Penny's motivation is unlike any that I've ever seen. Penny was never able to articulate where that thought came from. There did not appear to be any reason for it. No psychological problems, no history of abuse, nothing.
Penny is turning her fantasy into reality. She starts with targets.
She wanted to know what it was like to kill somebody. She wanted to know if she would feel any guilt or shame about it. Who it was just a random thing.
Soon, targets will not be enough.
I did. I spoke to Bob.
On the other side of town, the Norries are keen to start a family. Augie takes a second job to save money.
He was a type that if we didn't have money, he went out and got another job and then made more money. He said, we don't have enough money, I'll go make more.
Augie gets a weekend gardening job that takes him across town to the hills south of Daly City. Penny's favorite place for target practice. Augie is in the wrong place at the wrong time.
He had no idea that his life was going to end in minutes.
Like most teenagers, Penny Bjorklund is a dreamer.
but her fantasies are dark. She has an overwhelming desire to shoot someone.
She wanted to know what it was like to kill somebody. She wanted to know if she would feel any guilt or shame about it. It was just something that was always in her mind, if she could kill someone and not feel anything.
Penny has a gun, but she needs a target.
She had decided that that day was going to be the day she shot and killed someone. And that is what was on her agenda for the day when August Noori came by and offered her a ride.
Hey there. This feels a little steep to be walking up. Come on in. Come on.
Helpful gardener, August Noori, stops for the wrong girl.
Picking up someone to take them to where they wanted to be was certainly not anything that one would consider dangerous in 1959, let alone an 18-year-old girl.
Hey, what are you doing?
Hey, cut it out! That's how accidents happen. Gotta be careful with guns. I've been to Korea. I've seen what they can do.
Yeah?
Yeah, and it's not pretty. You don't ever want to see that.
But that's exactly what Penny does want to see. Years of fantasy finally come to life.
You're wrong about me. I do want to see what a gun can do.
No, no!
Penny pulled out her .38 caliber revolver and emptied it into August Noori. She walked around the car, opened the door, and fired six more times into him. She shot him in every part of his body. Then she reloaded again and shot him six more times. He was dead the first time she shot him. So it was a real big case of overkill.
Penny shoots 18 bullets into August Noori.
She did it because she wanted to. She wanted to know what it felt like to pull the trigger. And she did it over and over and over. When she ran out of bullets, she was done.
The next day, a passerby finds Augie's body riddled with holes.
They all thought it was a crime of passion. They all thought this guy had to have a girlfriend. Who else would shoot somebody 18 times? And it had to have been a lover's quarrel.
The only police witness seems to support the theory.
Around that area on that Sunday, a young boy saw a young blonde female driving her car erratically and told the police. So they thought, this is the woman. This is the person we're looking for.
Ballistic tests also help police zero in on the killer. Trace the casings to a blonde girl who likes to shoot in the hills.
Penny didn't try to hide. In fact, when she was arrested by the police and they searched her room, they found headlines.
Penny is dying to tell her story.
In the chest. And then I went outside and I shot four times. Bang, bang, bang.
She really didn't have a grip about how serious a thing that she had done. She had taken someone's life But it didn't mean anything to her.
Why'd you shoot him so many times, Penny?
Well, for a year and a half now, I've been dreaming about what it would be like to shoot someone.
Penny claims after the murder, she felt a strong sense of relief. She said she felt like a burden had been relieved from her, that the weight of the world had been lifted from her shoulders by pulling that trigger and killing someone.
Okay, I think that should just wrap it up.
The senseless killing shocks San Francisco.
We're done. Thank you, Penny.
A loving husband brutally murdered to satisfy a teenage curiosity.
She wanted to immediately plead guilty. She did not even want a trial. She said, I did it. That's all there is to it. I wanted to know how it felt. No need for a trial. Just take me to prison, I guess.
Because the murder is random, not premeditated, Penny Bjorklund is convicted of the lesser crime of second-degree murder. 9 years later, she is released on parole. For widow Darlene Nori, fate has been especially cruel. The strange schoolgirl claimed one more victim.
I probably found out a month after he was murdered that I was pregnant.
Her daughter, Cindy, never meets her father.
I remember when I had Cindy, and I was in the hospital, and this woman was in there with me, and she was all upset because her husband wasn't there right at that moment. And I kept thinking, but at least he's going to come. You know? So that was probably the hardest thing for me is when I had the baby.
Today, no one knows the whereabouts of Penny Bjorklund. These deadly women left lives and families devastated. Susanna Toledano would do anything for teenage loyalty. Greed made Sandra and Beth drown their own mother. And curiosity drove Penny Bjorklund to randomly take an innocent life. These girls were in a time of transition, changing from innocent children into teen killers.